Good morning. With 2 months to go in the school year, many Hawaii schools are already exploring how they'll fill teacher positions next year. Today, we'll hear why money may not be at the heart of the teacher shortage, but money and possibly erroneous science are central to the argument opposing the cesspool ban. We'll check in with a researcher who says both sides of the ban may be partly right. And we'll get a reality check on the visit by Jane Sanders to help Hawaii fill the burn. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The Lullaby Project is coming to the Leeward Theater, and project organizer John Senior will tell us how parents and caregivers are taking part. And Les Dames d'Escoffier Hawaii chapter is launching its 2016 Global Culinary Initiative Series.
It's Monday, March 21st. That's what's coming up on The Conversation right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation for a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. I guess there are any number of reasons why we have a teacher shortage, huh?
Well, we hear a lot of those reasons, and they usually boil down to money, conditions, etc. But we're going to talk a little bit about that this morning with someone who has a different perspective. Now, for years, Hawaii schools have been short on teachers. You know that. And according to the state teachers union, low salaries are a big part of the reason. With 2 months to go until the end of this school year, many schools are already considering how they will bridge the gap in August. But UH economist Jeff Trzezinski says they might want to examine some of his research that takes another view of the teacher shortage. We reached Jeff Trzezinski on the East Coast, and I asked him about the argument at the nexus of quality and pay.
I think that focusing on teacher quality is very important, and determining what qualities of teachers help make them better teachers, and how do we encourage those with those types of qualities to go into teaching in the first place. There's an idea in the economics of education literature that pay is not necessarily the way to get there. The idea is to think of teaching as a vocation, as a calling. And it makes the argument that raising salaries attracts people who like higher salaries, not necessarily people who really like teaching, and not necessarily the sort of people who would be most effective in the classroom. An alternative type of approach might be something along the lines of offering teachers money not in the form of salary, but in the form of something like paid summer training. Offering them a pool of money to say, look, you know, over the summer, we'll give you, you know, some amount of money. You can find programs that are really interesting to you that will help make you a more effective teacher, and the school may choose to pay for that. That sort of benefit might be more likely to attract people who really like teaching.
Jeff, what about the idea that in Hawaii, it's far more expensive to live? And that this is a matter of a living wage, and that teachers are putting far more of their own money to get everything from, you know, cute little things to give to their students to being able to get decorations for the classroom or whatever may be necessary, that they pay thousands of dollars from their own pockets every year. So even though the idea of quality through better training and a slush fund to be able to do that sounds really good too, I can imagine a lot of teachers will be saying, but wait a minute, that's not going to pay my bills.
What I would say is that when we think about wages that teachers can earn, there are a few things that are particular to Hawaii that I think are relevant to that. Hawaii actually has a single buyer of teacher services in the form of a single Department of Education. There are reasons to believe that having a single Department of Education may lead to lower wages for teachers through reduced competition for their services. When we think of the wages that then get bargained, it's often then a question of what else that teacher teacher could be doing on the outside. So to the extent that the sorts of skills that teachers have become in greater demand in the rest of the labor market in Hawaii, we would expect wages for teachers to rise. Now, if teachers feel that they're sort of not getting a good deal in terms of being a teacher, if the argument is that I could earn more money elsewhere, I would say that's an argument in favor of thinking of teaching as a vocation, in that they chose to be a teacher despite being able to earn more elsewhere. It suggests that these are folks who really value teaching. And that then the types of programs that I'm talking about are potentially more effective in that environment.
What we hear from a lot of teachers is that teaching has become so overladen with other issues, from the way they are evaluated to what happens in the classroom, with overcrowding to having to do so many different things in the classroom, then to have the economic burden on top of all of that seems to be, in their minds, just, you know, too much. And a lot of them will say that, I'm walking away from teaching. I just can't do this anymore, much as I love teaching. And so they're really caught between economic necessities and a love of teaching.
Something that may help there are incentives tied to effectiveness. If there's going to be more money put into teacher compensation in any form, finding a way to direct that money to the teachers who we think have the greatest positive impact on students becomes all the more important.
So you're talking about merit pay?
Yeah, in some sense. Being able to find an agreed-upon measure of effectiveness and rewarding that. The literature seems to agree that teachers seem to improve a lot in their effectiveness in their first couple years on the job. There's a very steep learning curve, and teacher effectiveness can rise a lot between really just those first 3 years or so on the job. We'd like to see that teachers are then rewarded for remaining after those 3 years. Making a particular effort to retain those teachers seems like a wise use of resources.
What is it that you see that might be an effective way for us in Hawaii to be able to attract and keep teachers?
The first that I think is maybe particularly worth mentioning, given that I'm at the University of Hawaii, is that in just about every state, teachers who are trained in that state appear to be more effective teachers than teachers trained out of state. Reasons for that, there are a couple. One is that if we're talking about kind of elementary and middle school teachers, those programs do vary more across states. And so a teacher who is trained in-state is likely to be better suited for schools in that state.
That sounds logical.
If you look at the state of New York, I think roughly 90% of teachers in the state of New York get their first job within 40 miles of where they went to high school.
So, I mean, we have, the College of Ed, and certainly we've had a long time shortage, and a lot of people know this, but aside from, the real calling to be a teacher, there's still the economic realities of Hawaii. Do you see that there's any way of changing that equation, short of simply saying we're going to give each teacher more money?
We have a responsibility, if we're going to be reasonable with this budget, to try to find the most cost-effective manner of getting there. Where can we find the greatest increase in teacher effectiveness per dollar? And there do appear to be some modifications in programs, in teacher training programs, that have been shown to be relatively effective. For instance, teacher training programs that have capstone-type projects, a project that requires the teacher in training to do something to link together what they learned in the classroom with what they have observed in their actual teaching practice. Programs with those type of capstone project produce more effective teachers. And that's likely a change that could be made to help produce more effective teachers at what I suspect is a relatively low cost.
All right, we're going to leave it there for the moment. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you when you get back to Hawaii.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to it.
Jeff Trzezinski is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. His work focuses on public policy, including the economics of education and the impact of accountability systems like No Child Left Behind on schools and students. We reached him on the East Coast.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Coming up, encouraging parents and caregivers to write their own lullabies. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're remembering the life of a Maui-born entertainer who won nationwide fame in the early 1960s. He won over mainland audiences with his portrayal of a singing cab driver named Kazuo Kim Kisato in the Warner Brothers detective series Hawaiian Eye. It was broadcast on ABC television from 1959 to 1963. His co-stars were Robert Conrad, Connie Stevens, and Anthony Isley. The show's opening credits show his character in an inner tube wearing a straw hat that became his trademark, strumming his ukulele. He portrayed an easygoing cabbie who knew the streets and acted as informant and occasional gumshoe for the two detectives in the lead. In his life outside the show, he was an enthusiastic student of martial arts who opened a karate studio in North Hollywood back in 1960, long before the whole country got on the martial arts bandwagon. During the heyday of Hawaiian Eye, he was known all over the country, and this morning we're looking for his name. If you know it, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Bud Spent from the Honolulu Museum of Art School. You're listening to The Conversation on HBR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Lullabies were probably some of the first songs. The act of soothing a baby offers us all the evidence we need of the power of music. Lullabies come straight from the heart, and the kind of pure communication they represent is at the heart of the Lullaby Project, which gives parents and caregivers the opportunity to write and record a song for a child. It's coming to the Leeward Theater in the form of a concert where those lullabies will be performed by professional singers and by a Leeward choir. John Signore is putting the project together. He's with us this morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, John. This is a wonderful project for a lot of reasons. How did you hear about it?
I was approached by Kemuel de Moville, who's Leeward Theater's manager, and Carnegie Hall is actually the organization that is running this program nationwide. So this is the sixth year. Mm-hmm. Carnegie Hall started this with two musicians in 2011, and it's growing across the country. So this is Hawaii's first year that we're participating. So I went to New York in November for workshops with musicians all across the country. And that's how that began, my process began.
So the process of creating this concert that's coming up starts with somebody who may or may not be a professional musician creating a song. Most of them are not professional musicians,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. These are not musicians. And so we partner, each mom or dad is partnered with a musician who facilitates or helps present ideas so that they can come up with their original lullaby for their baby. And in some cases, some of the moms are pregnant, so they haven't given birth yet.
So it starts with maybe some lyrics or a little fragment of melody.
Exactly. There's Carnegie Hall provides a lot of materials to help the process. So there's parents can write a letter to their baby. They're trying to think of why they gave their baby a certain name.
Mm-hmm.
They think about their baby as a young adult and what their wishes or hopes for their child would be, et cetera. So that kind of helps to pull out.
I would think it,
yeah.
I would think it would help a lot, John,
sure.
Real as triggers to a song. Yeah.
Yeah. And each parent and each song is so different. Yeah.
Well, as you well know, the process of starting a song from scratch can be a daunting one, right? It's like, what do I start with?
Yeah, sure.
You know, do I start with a little melody or a fragment of lyrics? But very few songwriters, even professional songwriters, have a song emerge whole cloth. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And this had to come immediately. We had an afternoon workshop. We had two workshops. So these parents are writing songs on the spot. But I think the thing that connects all the songs is the idea of inspiration,
mm-hmm.
and the stories, the powerful emotions that are coming out of the workshops. All of a sudden, the songs just are there. It's an amazing process, and each parent has a different musician. So I think for each parent, the process is different as well.
One of these has been recorded already, and we heard just a fragment of it before we started our interview. But let's play a little bit of a fragment.
Sure.
Dreams, dear Madeline, I'll read you a book, you'll have a good night. I love you so much, sweet Madeline.
Well, right away, John, that defies my stereotype of a lullaby, because it didn't put me to sleep, right?
Yes.
It's you know, rhythmic and alive, obviously a reggae.
Sure.
Tune in that case, but also a lullaby at the same time.
Sure.
So they go all over the place stylistically, these songs.
They do. Each song is really unique into itself, and a lot of it is that the parent is really coming from their musical perspective. What did they like to listen to? What did they like singing to their babies? And in this case, that particular song, Madeline's Lullaby, it's coming from Cincinnati, Ohio. We're partnering with a group there called My Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually written by a classroom of orchestra students who are ages 4 to 6. And
wow.
So they created a lullaby. We're sending them one of our lullabies to record and perform. So
Those lyrics came from young kids?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And in our lullaby project, we'll have one of our students also singing a song he composed for his mother. So this reverse situation happens where a child is now singing for the parent.
You know, that speaks to something, a phenomenon that I see all the time through this radio show, is that people have a lot more creativity in them than they realize,
mm-hmm.
particularly when they're young.
Absolutely.
You almost have to have it beaten out of you, in a sense, right?
And it just dawned on me that I think sometimes because the songs are coming so fast and from such inspiration that sometimes we can get caught up in that fact, but these parents were just, the song was there.
Yeah.
It just came out. And so it's really fun from that perspective to see that, yeah, we're all composers, whether we know it or not.
It's, right. And you tapped into a very reliable font of inspiration, because if you can't be inspired by your child, chances are you can't be inspired by much of anything, right?
It was beautiful. It is beautiful. It's beautiful to see the songs coming, to see my students arranging them, to hear them, to rehearse them. It's really special.
With the parent originators, I'm sure at first you ran into all kinds of reluctance. Oh, I'm not a singer. I'm not a musician. How do you help them get over that?
You know, I, as a teacher, I come across my students say that often. And, you know, I think once you realize that that's just something that's not true, we're all singers, we all, it's, and to break, and to start doing it, all of a sudden you realize, oh, I can. And the idea is that you're not just singing this one song to your baby. You're just going to keep creating other lullabies as well.
Yeah, let's hope it really opens up something in the people who take part, John. It's a wonderful project.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
John Signor is the project manager for the Lullaby Project, which will be performed Saturday, April 2nd at the Leeward Theater on the campus of Leeward Community College. Lullabies will be performed by Leeward Community College's Hawaiian Ensemble and guest vocalist Naiha Breland, Nara Cardenas, Annalise Esopenko, Star Kalahiki, Christian Lay, and Sharon Myung.
Smile, darling child, no need to fear. If the wind blows, your loved ones are near. If the bough breaks, we'll all learn to fly. We'll journey together in a lullaby.
Who's man in Havana? The president who wants to close Gitmo goes to the other end of the island to open up Cuba. Obama, U.S.-Cuban baseball, and footsteps of history that go way back before the Cold War. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
More and more station members are choosing continuous monthly giving as their preferred way to financially support Hawaii Public Radio and its work. Mahalo to Ann Tokoro of Honolulu, Barbara and Francis Hasegawa of IAEA, and Mary O'Brien Ichikawa of Honolulu for their sustaining memberships. Sustaining membership is steadily lowering the amount of day-to-day operating support needed to be raised over the air. To become a sustaining member at the $10 a month level, call us at 955-8821 during business hours or go to hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting vocalist Lisa Fisher and her band Grand Baton, 7:30 p.m. this Thursday in Castle Theater. Tickets at mauiarts.org.
Rarely do presidential candidates come to campaign in Hawaii. More often we see them elsewhere or just in political ads. This time around, that's true too, though this weekend, Jane Sanders came to Hawaii to help Hawaii feel the burn. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Okay, so we didn't get a visit from Bernie, but he sent his best emissary, who made a couple of public appearances yesterday, obviously meant to inspire the party faithful or those who are certainly the supporters of Bernie Sanders. But what was her essential message about the chances for success of this campaign?
Well, you know, first of all, in many ways, Jane Sanders has become nearly as famous as her husband. She's a bit of a personality on her own at her husband's side throughout the campaign, and she took time to fly from Arizona, because there's a primary there tomorrow, to spend 2 days here. And she effectively said it's not over yet, even though it seems like it's a little bit disconcerting that the delegate count is going Hillary Clinton's way by a pretty large margin, actually. She said that we think we can still do it. They've actually done the math. Most of the primaries that are left are in Western states. And I mentioned Arizona. I think it's also Idaho and Utah. Remember, you have California coming up and New York and Wisconsin. She thinks, she said as much, that by June 7th, when California votes, she feels that they will prevent Hillary from getting the nomination, the delegate count necessary to go to the convention. So we'll see. But she certainly, the supporters that showed up, about 400 yesterday at the Church at Crossroads alone, feel that they have a candidate that can win.
And clearly that was good news for them to hear her say that even if she's done the math or they've done the math, that there may be the rocky road, but a road right. that they can travel. The other appearance that she made was with veterans. Why did she single out veterans?
I think it had a lot to do with Tulsi Gabbard, who very prominently has endorsed the campaign, who has been actually campaigning for Bernie Sanders in a number of mainland locations. She was there yesterday. Of course, she is our U.S. Congresswoman, 2nd District. She is a veteran, as we all know. And she and Jane Sanders took questions, heard how things are going, concerns about suicide in the ranks, concerns that the Veterans Administration not moving fast enough, any number of concerns. Sanders also said that her husband had taken veterans issue and made them a priority and cited his service in Congress to that effect. She seemed quite sincere. It didn't seem like it was lip service in any way. Clearly concerned, as Tulsi put it, the biggest thing Bernie Sanders can do is make sure we don't get into another war unless it's one that is absolutely necessary. And that's a campaign position that that many people in Hawaii find very appealing.
And that idea of unless absolutely necessary is obviously really subjective depending upon who you talk to. But at least at this point, because isn't she leaving today to go and be back in Arizona for...
Actually, they'll be in California, she told me, tonight tomorrow night, Tuesday night, for the election returns coming in. And a reminder, that's the other thing. She was here to remind everybody, Democrats, vote on Saturday. There is a presidential preference poll. By the way, you can read about that on our website. We got all the precinct locations posted.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Thanks so much, Chad. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Beth. Ann. Bye.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook. It's 8:30, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. You can talk back about what you hear on the show to our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up later, learning the ways of the master chef after the news from Deutsche Welle.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the State of Hawaii, offering Hawaii tax-exempt bonds to individual investors on March 30th. More information, including the preliminary official statement for bonds, is available from a registered broker.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, I didn't realize just how common colon cancer was.
You know, it really is. Every year it's in the top 3 for both men and women. And March is National Colon Cancer Screening Awareness Month. So we're going to talk about all the different options and then talk about what to do if you've been diagnosed with, you know, some people have polyps and they don't know what to do or when to follow up. And we're going to go over all of that today.
A lot of people are reluctant to do the necessary testing, you know?
Well, you know, everybody I talk to, it's not the test, it's the prep the day before. Mm-hmm. It's just not the most pleasant experience. But, you know, we're going to talk about some of the new alternatives that are out there now, because there are some options for different modalities of testing that a lot of folks don't realize. So if you really are scared or afraid of doing the full colonoscopy, that doesn't mean you don't have to do anything. There's new options for you.
Well, that's going to be a comfort to a lot of people because...
Literally.
Yeah, as with every kind of cancer, early detection is what it's about, right?
Well, if you detect colon cancer early, in the polyp phase or in the very early phase, you can cure it. That's really the key.
Wow.
But if people wait until they have symptoms, it's probably advanced.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks very much, Kathy. We'll hope to learn more about that.
And absolutely. Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
A few weeks ago, Governor Ige signed new Department of Health rules banning new cesspools in Hawaii. That was after several lawmakers sent a letter imploring him to consider the situation of more rural areas of the state. Last week, we spoke to one of the champions of the opposition, Representative and physician Richard Cregan. He said that there were no problems with cesspools in the upper elevations on the Big Island, for example, and that for people building in rural areas, the cost of a septic system was prohibitive and unnecessary based on science. Roger Babcock says he's partly right. Mr. Babcock is a UH Manoa Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to talk to you. Now, in that letter that several lawmakers sent in February, they said, quote, because of our high temperatures, much of the fluid is likely to be vaporized. Nitrogen in the waste is largely gasified, while phosphorus is tightly bound to the surrounding rock and moves very little. Is that a valid assessment?
Well, it would be nice if that was the way such systems work, but they don't really work that way. The physics and chemistry and biology, you know, tell us something different.
What exactly do they say?
Well, a cesspool is basically a disposal device, so we don't think of it as a treatment device. It's basically, another word for it would be a seepage pit. It's a device where you put water in so that it would seep out rapidly and enter the ground. You don't want water to pool up or overflow or whatever. So it's basically a hole in the ground where water will disperse from. And in order to do treatment, a significant amount of treatment, you have to have a different kind of device.
Okay, if you need a different kind of device for doing the treatment, what about then what the opposition has been saying, that, for example, it gets self-treated because of the higher elevation, because it's lava rock, all of that, and that the soil is, in effect, porous. Does that affect what you see?
Right. So because it's porous, that means that the water drains out very rapidly, and any material that's left behind would be solid material that it can't pass into the pores. So solid material would include, you know, things like paper and whatever you put down the drain, which is shower water and sinks and toilets. So you'd have solid material would be retained in a pile, essentially, in the bottom of a cesspool, and the water would drain out very rapidly. So anything that's in that water, dissolved materials would just rapidly infiltrate into the ground. So it doesn't stay there at the surface to evaporate or vaporize. In order for nitrogen components in that liquid water to be transformed, say biologically, that requires different microorganisms to work together in a couple different kinds of organisms under different conditions, and that requires an engineered system to do. We spend quite a bit of effort and money to do that in treatment plants. But it doesn't occur easily in a system like that.
So you're saying that gasification doesn't naturally occur because it's really a two-part process. One that happens whatever, you know, naturally occurring things, bacteria may be in the water to do that, but then there has to be something else that's done additionally?
Correct, yeah. So that would be for the nitrogen. So to do nitrogen gasification, it requires a first an aerobic step and then an anoxic step, and that requires some doing to make that happen.
So if this is, in fact, what you show and what research, you know, bears out, how is it then that, you know, those people who have been opposing the cesspool ban, specifically in rural areas, are able to justify it with their science. Is this a case of, well, my science is better than your science?
Well, I don't know of any science that would say that those things occur. I think it would be nice to wish that that would happen, but the science doesn't show that. Now, I would point out that that doesn't mean that the main statement that cesspools work fine in certain places, that kind of depends on the perspective of what you mean works fine. Something can work in the sense that the water disappears, a lot of stuff doesn't accumulate, it never overflows. So from the homeowner's point of view, that works fine, right? It's not a problem. It doesn't cause them any problems. But in terms of working fine for the environment or for the water table below where the water is infiltrating to, that's a different question. It's not working fine for that.
And some of the things that we've heard is that, well, the water table is far away from where a lot of these areas are, where cesspools may be in rural areas, for example. Is there any sort of compromise position you think that Hawaii should be taking, or do you think that having the outright ban is absolutely the way to go?
Well, I mean, I think the way to look at it is if, you know, there's parallels with other things, possibly medicine, for example. I think, you know, we do vaccinations to do prevention. So if we accept the idea that the science that says that these systems don't really treat anything, and whatever's in the water is going to infiltrate very rapidly downward and eventually make it to groundwater, the groundwater then would become, you know, contaminated. The question is whether that water is used by anybody or needs to be now or maybe in the future. So it's kind of like contaminating water and then worrying about it later. You're either going to prevention is a much easier way to than contaminating something and having to clean it up later when you want to drink it or use it for something else. I think one thing, the way people could think about it is if you have real clean groundwater below you, which comes from rainfall and stuff like that, and it's pretty pure. And then you have some of this other water, sewage water, that you just put through a bed of rock, and you have the water that came out of that. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can kind of imagine what that water's like. So if you were to then mix those two waters together in whatever proportion you want, I think the question you're asking is, well, if I was then going to drink that mixture of water, what kind of treatment would I want to have had for before I mix those two waters together? So it's kind of about prevention and looking ahead.
All right. Professor Babcock, thank you very much for your time this morning.
You're very welcome. Have a nice day.
You too. Roger Babcock is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at UH Manoa. He also chairs a civil and environmental engineering graduate program and specializes in biological wastewater treatment, reuse, and recycling.
In today's backyard quiz, we went looking for the name of the actor who played a singing, ukulele-playing cab driver on the ABC television series Hawaiian Eye. The show ran from 1959 to 1963, and he could be found in most episodes lounging against his cab, ukulele in hand, ready with a wisecrack. He was born on Maui in 1933 to Maria and Alberto Hernandez, attended Honoka'a High School, and pursued a career as a welder at Hawaii Vocational School. When he went into the Army and was deployed to Germany in 1953, he started honing a comedy act in Munich nightclubs. He took his act home and gained confidence in local talent shows before a move to Los Angeles and his breakthrough role in a hit show. His Hawaiian Eye character's name was Kazuo Kim Kisado, but he was born Ponciano Hernandez, a name that became the source of his stage name, Poncy Ponce.
And we had a call from Beatrice Lemke Newman from Kapaa, and she said that she and her sisters were fans of the show. In fact, they have signed headshots from Anthony Isley, Poncy Ponce, Connie Stevens, and Robert Conrad. Between
Can't beat
she and
that.
Her sister. Absolutely. Thanks very much for calling in. We can only send you one T-shirt, though, and you'll get it very soon. Now it's 8:45, and that was today's quiz. If you've got a question for us, send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Lavor Addison from the University of Hawaii at Manoa, studying theater. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
Stargazer time. Our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet. And as usual, we turn to our good friend Christopher Phillips to see what's happening. Hey, Christopher, what's going on out there?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for the planet Jupiter rising in the early evening around 5:14 p.m. Jupiter is the largest planet in the solar system, and this makes it very easy to spot with the naked eye. The moon will be passing through its full phase this week. This, of course, means that stargazing for those faint objects in the heavens will be very hard work indeed.
And I imagine it'd be really hard work to see the mysterious spots on Ceres, which I understand you have an update on.
Yes, we are returning again to Ceres this week, and the ever-deepening mystery of those enigmatic bright spots. The bright spots of Ceres have been causing all sorts of kerfuffle since they were first identified by NASA's Dawn spacecraft. Their origin is a mystery, but new observations by ground-based telescopes have confirmed that the bright spots change throughout the day.
And what might be causing the brightness to change?
Well, observations by observatories in Chile have hinted that something really awesome could be happening here. The brightening of these spots could be linked to sunlight that is heating up ice, which in turn creates a haze and plumes of gas.
And then how would they get dark again? Lack of light?
Exactly. Just as sunlight warms the ice during the Ceres day, the ice will refreeze at night when the sun sets. We think that this is responsible for the changes in brightness that we're seeing. Now, if confirmed, it would add real credence to the theory that there is a salt water ocean hiding just under the surface of Ceres.
And why was the Dawn spacecraft unable to detect this change in the color?
Well, the spacecraft is always on the move, so it's entirely likely that Dawn was just not in the right position to see this happen. The fact that this was spotted by scopes here on the Earth goes to show that in some cases, being far away from an object can actually give you a unique perspective. You can think of it like standing in front of a painting with your nose touching the canvas. You might see the canvas really well, but you need to take a step back if you want to see the whole picture.
That makes a lot of sense. And real quick, is that mist that it creates from the water turns into mist in the air?
It is. Something's going on here with the salty water ice.
Well, we'll hope to get more information on that in an upcoming Stargazer. Thank you for the report.
You're welcome, Dave.
Christopher Phillips, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
There's been a quiet revolution in American kitchens for the last couple of generations. A growth in appreciation of cooking as an art, an explosion in the variety of ingredients available to the home chef, and an understanding that American food has earned a place among the cuisines of the world. Kusuma Kure is a longtime member of Les Dames d'Escoffier Hawaii chapter and a professor in the Kapi'olani Community College's Culinary Arts Program. She's conducting a cooking demonstration next week, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Kusuma. Thanks
Good
for
morning,
coming.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning.
A lot of people are hesitant to become real creative cooks because they think it's has to be complicated. Is that true?
No, it's not true. If you do things right, then simple, the simplest thing can be the best dish in the world.
What's an example of doing something right?
It's like, let's say take a piece of fish, it's got to be fresh. That's when it's at its best.
Yeah.
So what I would do is, use butter and cream. I love butter and cream,
mm-hmm.
and a little white pan. So have a nice sauté pan, nice and hot, with a little butter, and season the fish and put down the presentation side first. And when as it's getting brown, you can add a little white wine.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and then turn it over so you'll see the presentation side nice and golden brown. And the wine will steam the fish. It's simple and nice, a little lemon juice and on the plate. That makes a nice, quick and fast piece of, it makes a nice lunch.
And
with a little salad. Of course, you can go further, make a little beurre blanc in the same pan. You can whip in a little... add a little cream to that pan that has all the brownings and season again. So, and whisk in a little more butter, and that's your sauce made in, and that's the best thing in the world, I would think.
As soon as you start talking about butter and cream,
yes.
a lot, you're going to run up against what Julia Child used to refer to
yeah.
as the fear of food.
Food.
Right. Where, oh, no, butter can't do that.
Oh, no,
but
no.
In moderation.
Yes, yes, nothing like butter and cream. So there are simple ways of doing things. You do things right, and doesn't have to be complicated. Good food is not complicated. If you're comfortable, you can make a nice dish for yourself, or you can entertain.
You've taught yes. For years in a culinary arts program.
Yes.
And I'm sure you ran into people who said, oh, I'm not good at this. I don't.
Yes.
How do you overcome that?
Well, show them that that's what I was there for. I show them that it's easy to know what you're doing and start simply, fresh food and simple techniques. There are simple techniques. You don't have to make things complicated mm-hmm. for yourself.
I've heard people talk about going to Cordon Bleu and
yes.
and learning how to make scrambled eggs as something that
yes.
was taken very seriously.
Yes. Yes, there's a right way of doing things, You can't rush. You have to control your temperature. And that's what it is. Of course, as we go on, we teach them good techniques and methods.
Well, a lot of it. But most of these techniques are really within
anyone's
reach, right?
Correct, yes.
So it has to do with how long to cook things, how you regulate
yes.
temperatures, sauces
and,
to add.
And you should also, it just comes naturally. Of course, you can't overcook an egg, yeah? Like when we started, even as kids, we used to cook eggs. So the basic thing is you cannot overcook an egg. Or for that matter, anything, then you have to control your temperature. You cannot burn things.
Yeah.
Or you cannot have them raw. So
you're looking for that happy medium.
Medium, yes. Yeah, you got to use some common sense, I think.
Well, just going back to that example you gave of the piece of fish, and
fish.
I think that the ability to cook fish is really kind of the measure of
yes.
a cook, don't you?
Yes, yes. That's pretty much the most difficult thing to do.
Getting it just right.
Because meats have connective tissues. You cook a long time, but fish cannot. It does not have much connective tissue.
Oh.
Yeah. That's why as it cooks, it falls apart like.
Yeah.
So you have to be... pretty much, you don't know what you're doing with
fish. You have to stay with it, right?
With it,
you
yes.
can't just sort of
yes.
put it away and
yes.
go do something else.
Yeah.
But that's a good point, because with the connective tissue in meat,
yes.
you have more leeway.
Leave it, yes.
Whereas with fish, it's very low tolerance. If you do too much,
yes.
you've ruined it.
Yes.
Not enough, it's not edible.
Edible.
So you have
yes.
to really catch that sweet spot.
And I've just last... Yeah, I launched my book on fish,
uh-huh.
how to cook fish, yes.
What are the main things that you need to keep in mind? Just keep an eye on it and understand?
Yeah, basically, you cannot overcook. That's one of the faults. Unless you want your fish raw, then we love fresh fish.
Yeah.
At it's best when it's raw. So that's a different thing. But if you're cooking, you got to go cook it just through it and not and still see it nice and pink and moist in the center.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course, depending on the kind of fish.
A lot of that is just sort of
knowing what
a good end result looks like, right?
Yes. But people cook fish especially in the islands. Basically, we all know how to cook a piece of fish.
Well, let's hope so. But thanks very much for coming in this morning.
You're welcome.
Kusuma Kure will conduct a cooking demonstration Wednesday, March 30th, at Chef Zone in Honolulu. It's sponsored by Les Dames d'Escoffier Hawaii Chapter as part of its 2016 Global Culinary Initiative series, Cuisines of the World.
Beirut, Palestine, Honolulu. We're connected by our ties to the land. Cultures spring from the land that shapes them. In a time of global dislocation, we've planned an evening to explore identity, culture, and our relationships to the land through art. Tuesday, 6 p.m., free in HPR's Atherton studio. Call 955-8821 during business hours to reserve.
Beth Ann, if anyone listening to this morning's show learns how to cook a fish properly, we will not have lived in vain.
That's true. I can remember when I was very young and hanging out in the kitchen with my mother and my friends' mothers and all that, and the one rule about fish was don't screw it up.
Yeah.
Well, not a lot of discussion of what not screwing it up meant.
Exactly. But if you want to find out if somebody can cook, give them a piece of fish and see what they do. But it's been wonderful to watch the progression in America over the last couple of generations toward really an understanding of how to cook, what to cook.
And how not to overcook.
How not to overcook, yes. And the availability of ingredients. I mean, when I was a kid, there was one kind of lettuce in the store. The
tomatoes,
yeah, iceberg. Flavor-free tomatoes, that looked great, but there really wasn't anything.
You can still get those, though, if you're really hankering for them. Well, the idea that we are learning a lot more about not only what's nutritionally sound, but what tastes good, too. And some of that really harkens back to beautiful old gardens. My grandfather had a wonderful old garden and have many memories of just walking around with a salt shaker and pulling things off the vine and just sitting there as a tiny child and just munching away.
That's how it should be.
I think so, too. But then again, what do we know? You probably know better, and we're going to talk more about some of the things that we all would like to know better come tomorrow. Up for discussion is the Democratic presidential poll coming up on Saturday. We'll be talking with Rep. Takashi Ono.
And a high school science project with global potential.
We'd like to hear from you, too. You can call our talkback line anytime you like. That number is 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.